You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There are now more than 7 billion people on the planet, and that means our ecological footprint has become bigger and more damaging than ever. But have all of our technological achievements merely paved the way for our own extinction? In a book called The Fate of the Species, Fred Guterl, the executive editor of Scientific American, explores the powerful worst-case scenarios he says we may be only a few wrong turns away from. His book is published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased it has brought Fred Guterl to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Now, we constantly hear reports about all the ways we might be causing our own demise: climate change, superviruses, biowarfare, the list goes on. Your book tackles all of those scary scenarios. How afraid should we be?
Well, that's a good question. I get asked, how can you be an optimist quite a lot?
You're smiling.
Well, you know, maybe that's a congenital defect. I don't know. Personality disorder. The book explores, from the get-go, it explores really worst-case scenarios. I mean, how bad can things be? And, you know, we hear a lot of stories that have apocalyptic overtones. You know, every climate story has a kind of an apocalyptic overtone to it. Flu epidemics, that sort of thing, bioterrorism. And I just wanted to it's sort of like I think of it as sitting around a campfire and telling stories about what could be out there. But you're sitting with people who, scientists, who actually maybe know a thing or two about what could be out there.
How much is this all linked, at least in human terms, to population explosion? Historically, what has happened to populations that grow this quickly?
Well, you're actually getting at something that was really, really crystallized this idea for me. I was talking with an ecologist about her work, which was with hunter-gatherer societies and food webs and this sort of thing. And she sort of – we talked about the human population. And, you know, I mean, people know the broad outlines. I mean, when, you know, my dad was born, there were fewer than 2 billion people on the planet. There are now 7 billion. And the United Nations projections now go – you know, they have a nice smooth curve that rises to about 10 billion people at the end of the century, and then levels off. And she said to me, you know, that's not what populations do. They don't rise quickly and then level off to a nice steady state. They reach a steady state at some point, but there's often a little bit of wobbling going on, and populations that rise very quickly tend to crash. And so this was a very chilling prospect.
And what would a crash like that look like, and what might trigger it?
Well, that is exactly what this book is about. And some of the things that I've come up with are disease, diseases that we either occur in nature or that we create. It could be climate. We tend to think of climate as something that happens slowly, that changes slowly, but that's not necessarily the case.
Has it changed quickly in the past? For example, dinosaurs are believed to have been killed off 65 million years ago by a huge meteorite, nothing to do with climate, although the climate did affect them because it was all that, I guess, the dust was affecting the air. But what caused the three mass extinctions that occurred before that, 252 million years ago, 600 million years ago, and 2,400 million years ago?
Well, these were two of those were caused by things that have eerie parallels to what's happening now. The main way, the most visible way we're changing the planet, and not the only way, but probably the most visible way is climate, is carbon, you know, carbon pumping. We're pumping a lot of carbon into the atmosphere, and we're increasing the proportion of carbon. 250 or so million years ago, there was a lot of volcanic activity, which basically the lava was flowing out of these volcanoes and vaporized a huge carbon coal pit right around where Siberia is now. And this released a lot of carbon into the atmosphere and very suddenly. And by suddenly, I mean over, probably over 100 years or a few decades. We don't exactly know. And that led to a very large mass extinction event.
What kind of life was on the planet at the time?
Oh, they weren't things you could make a movie out of. They were things like sponges and worms and things like that. And they were ambulatory, but they moved very slowly. And but 90% of them were wiped out, which is quite a lot. I mean, we're not talking about 90% of individuals, we're talking about 90% of species.
But when 10% remain, there's this vacuum to be filled, and usually they thrive as a result.
That's right. For some species that survive, there's a new beginning. You can see that in the fossil record. You know, you go back to 252 million years ago, and you see all these species, and then you go a million or so years in the more recent past, and you see one kind of clam. You know, and for this clam, the life was great right after the mass extinction. But that's little solace for humans, because we are not going to be one of the species that survives if there's a mass extinction event underway, and it's not certain that there is.
It's back to the sponges.
It's not going to be us and the cockroaches. It's going to be the cockroaches.
My guest is Fred Gutterl, Gutterl. His book, The Fate of the Species, Why the Human Race May Cause Its Own Extinction and How We Can Stop It. You write that global warming is something of a misnomer. Would you prefer that we call it climate change?
Well, they're political. There's been political baggage attached to these words. I think that they're both misleading. Climate change is a neutral word. I mean, it implies that climate could change by temperatures going up or temperatures going down. For the purposes of this book, I concentrated more on was the what we think about when we think about either one of climate change or global warming. And we tend to think about these things as being – we tend to think in the average. So we talk about average temperatures, and the UN predicts an average change over the next so many number of years in a certain range. And the thing that I really point out here is that even if those predictions, projections really, of average changes are correct – it doesn't mean that change is going to be smooth, that change is going to be gradual. Change can happen very suddenly.
So I've just read that the last decade was the hottest in recorded history in the United States. So is that just something that would be part of the normal give and take, or should we assume that this is the result of some kind of climate change?
Well, that's a very difficult question, and the line that scientists will give you is that you can't connect specific years, specific temperature performances to climate change, because climate change is a very complex phenomenon. However, you do begin to get the sense that a lot of coincidences are occurring that would tell us that the predictions that climate scientists have been making about warming temperatures are coming to pass. And it's not just temperature. It's also things like a rate of glacial melt, rate of sea rise, and things like that. So you add all that together, and you begin to get a picture that, it does look like the climate is changing.
But when the climate has changed in the past and other things have changed in the past, species adapted, didn't they? Isn't that what Darwin wrote about?
Well, and it's interesting because Darwin, and the acceptance of Darwin has given us a feeling that evolution is this kind of gradual thing, And so we tend to think about the world in terms of gradual change. So, well, let's not worry too much because things change gradually and we can adapt.
Well, we'll develop webs in our feet and be able to walk in the, through the marshes more easily.
But you know, nature is not kind to individual species. You know, if it's time for an individual species to go, it's time for that species to go.
Well, during the 20th century, we lost a lot of species. Has it had much of an impact?
Yeah, I mean there has been a lot of species lost, and we've seen what we do know is that the landscape has changed in many places. I mean Edward O. Wilson wrote a lovely book about where he talked a lot about Hawaii. And how the Hawaiian Islands have very little of the flora and fauna that was natural to them. It's all been taken over by species that have come from other places and that have come to predominate. We hear this about Australia and the United States too.
But Hawaii is really just our volcanic islands. All of the original species came from outside also.
Well, what we're seeing is we're seeing loss of species, and we're seeing a kind of a homogenization of species. There are species that are spread from one habitat to another and tend to take over, and so we're seeing a loss of diversity. Now, you ask if that's had an impact. We've seen a rise in things like fungal diseases, like the white nose syndrome in bats. Frogs have had fungal diseases. We've seen an epidemic of wheat rust that started in Uganda and is spreading east.
Bees are disappearing.
Bees, the colony collapse disorder.
Now that could, if we lose some of those things, it really will have a major impact. Bees are really important for all vegetation.
Right.
Bats are important as well.
Well, and we don't know even how important which species are. I mean, we know that bees are important because they pollinate crops that we grow and we sell and we make money and we eat the food. But we don't know how complicated this web of life is, and we don't know. It's like taking out the oranges in a grocery store. You can take a few out and nothing happens, but how can you take one more out, and when will the oranges all topple?
When we've talked about the extinction of bees in the past, it really comes down to the way we deal with bees as humans. You mentioned Hawaii. Hawaii changed after humans came to the islands. So are we the major cause of all of these changes?
I think you have to say that we are the major cause of many of these changes. I mean, we are a huge force on this planet. We're changing the makeup of our climate, the chemistry of our climate. We're changing. Our agriculture is introducing a lot of monoculture crops. Huge fields of single crops, whereas before you had wild things and a big diversity of species. Our physical presence, we're cut down trees. We're changing the albedo of the planet, the amount of heat that gets absorbed from the sun. I mean, we're making gigantic changes to the planet. I mean, that's indisputable. Now, this is not this is not some shameful thing. I don't think. I think this is we are very successful. We're a very successful species because we have the attributes. We've adapted to the world, and we've been able to use our intelligence and our ingenuity to our own advantage. And now the question is, can we take the next step and use that to get us out of this mess?
Because we've always relied on our brilliance and ability to come up with new technologies to save us from disasters. But there are
right.
many people are wondering whether that's possible now, whether we have crossed the right. tipping point, as Malcolm Gladwell would have called it. We'll take a little break and come back and address that and other issues like pandemics and such. As this conversation with Fred Gutterl continues, he's executive editor of Scientific American and spent 10 years at Newsweek, where he covered science, technology, and international affairs. His book, The Fate of the Species, Why the Human Race May Cause Its Own Extinction and How We Can Stop It, published by Bloomsbury. We're back with Fred Gutterl, G-U-T-E-R-L, who is the executive editor of Scientific American. He's written a book called The Fate of the Species, Why the Human Race May Cause Its Own Extinction and How We Can Stop It, published by Bloomsbury. Do you argue at Scientific American whether to pronounce species or species?
No, we do not have that argument.
Okay. I'm glad. In 2009, when the World Health Organization declared the influenza outbreak a pandemic, many already knew that it was a mild form and definitely wasn't as serious as the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. Did experts overreact?
No, they didn't. The World Health Organization waited a long time before declaring it a pandemic. But there really wasn't an overreaction. At the time that the virus was discovered, it had completely and utterly surprised virologists and people at the WHO and elsewhere. They didn't see it coming. They had no idea that this particular type of flu was, you know, knocking on the door and in danger of becoming a pandemic. And they quickly established that it was mild, that the symptoms were mild. But when they first found out about it in the first hours, there was, I don't want to say panic because these are very level-headed people, but there was serious concern. And the concern is that, you know, it takes months to respond to a new virus, to a new flu virus. It takes something like 6 months to manufacture a vaccine and get it into production and make enough to distribute to people. So that and the virus, these flu viruses spread very quickly from one end of the world to the other. So if you did have a brand new virus that no one was watching, and there were no vaccines prepared for it, and we were not lucky enough for it to be mild, it could cause quite a lot of casualties, and the scientists would be powerless to stop it in the first wave.
Well, we've seen near extinctions in the past: the Black Plague, Typhus wiping out a major portion of the indigenous people of the Americas, the 1918 flu pandemic, which took the lives of around 50 million people, wouldn't they have been seen as serious causes of extinction at the time?
Well, they were certainly very serious population corrections. I think extinction is a bigger bar. You know, it's a higher bar to clear. There are two ideas that are here. There's the idea of a population crash, a kind of a population correction, which you know,
correction makes it sound so nice and technical.
Yeah, it makes it sound like a stock market index. but you know, that could be, you know, if we had a rapid crash, you know, you could talking about lots of casualties in a very ugly situation, something like the Black Death, which in the 14th century in some places in Europe killed 50% of the people. And now extinction is something different. Extinction is something that you know, that just really has to do more than cause a lot of deaths. It has to really fundamentally change conditions so that our species is no longer adapted to survive. And that's, you know, it's a little tougher to do.
Like what happened with the giant sea turtle. The last one just died, as far as we know.
Right. Yeah. That's an extinction of a species as far as we know. Mass extinction is, again, you know, lots of species. So that's you know, we've seen a lot of species loss, but we still don't know if we're in a mass extinction event. That's a different thing.
Many people are concerned about biotechnology as something that can be negative as well as positive. There are even conspiracy theorists who believe that AIDS was created by the CIA and or mad doctors or whatever. But there is a real problem, isn't there? I mean, isn't bioterrorism a serious concern, or shouldn't it be?
It is, and it should be. You know, one of the scientists that I spent quite a lot of time with, Yoshi Kawaoka, is an influenza expert, and he has been very concerned for many years that a bird flu could jump to humans and create a very nasty disease, human pathogen. And he's been working for decades to find out what makes this virus tick and, you know, how we can stop it. And he published a paper in Nature magazine just recently, and the publication of this paper was blocked for months by the White House and by the White House biosecurity people. And they were afraid, for one, that this kind of research could, maybe was being performed in labs that didn't have proper security and things, somebody could get infected and create a pandemic by their own research, or they were afraid that by publishing it, they're basically publishing a cookbook that people could use to create a very nasty virus. And then we've seen from 9/11 that there are people out there who are have the mindset to do something that would even result in their own destruction for a cause. So that's a very real concern. It's not that easy right now to make a flu virus. I mean, I couldn't do it. You know, it can only be done in a handful of labs, but this kind of technology has a way of becoming cheaper, and the expertise has a way of getting around. So that in a few years, that may not be the case.
My guest is Fred Gutterl. His book, The Fate of the Species: Why the Human Race May Cause Its Own Extinction and How We Can Stop It, published by Bloomsbury. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We are increasingly dependent on digital technology, and there's a big political push to get America's electrical grid wired to the Internet. Well, we just saw problems because of the wiring to the Amazon facilities. You write that such a smart grid would make us more vulnerable to malware, but couldn't a smart grid help prevent blackouts like the one we experienced here in the Northeast in 2003?
Well, the Internet is a wonderful thing. It's brought us, terrific technology, terrific capabilities. It also has brought us vulnerabilities. And the Internet was designed by long time ago in an environment where academics were using it among themselves, and they all trusted one another. And we've been catching up with security ever since. And what we've got now are computer programs like, and this is the poster boy for this kind of program was the virus called Stuxnet. That we now know that U.S. Military folks dreamed up. They wrote it for the specific purpose of targeting Iran's uranium enrichment facilities. And I call Stuxnet, it's like the Jason Bourne of computer viruses. You know, it's not something that you can get rid of by running McAfee this is a virus that is wholly new. No one could recognize it. It just is invisible. It's small. It fits on a thumb drive, and it has in it the kinds of artificial intelligence capabilities that we could only dream of a few years ago. And the ability to write this kind of malware leaves us very vulnerable to the U.S. was very successful in delaying Iran's weapons program, And we are also vulnerable to a similar technology on something like our power grid.
So why the president has been pushing for this to happen? They must be aware of the negative aspects of it.
Well, it's not so much that the power grid is connected to the internet. There are good reasons to connect the power grid up to the internet, and it has to do with managing electricity. But the Iranian uranium enrichment, the Iranian uranium enrichment plant was not wired to the internet. It was air gapped. So this virus, Stuxnet, was able to find it anyway through human error. You know, you have a technician who will have a thumb drive and will mistakenly plug it into his laptop, and then he'll go and, you know, he'll say, there's nothing on this. I know. No one would plant I know what I'm doing. You know, it's the same kind of hubris that we've heard over and over again.
Well, we've spent so much time on all the scary stuff. We haven't really addressed your subtitle, and we have very little time. Why the human race, how we can stop all of this. So how do we stop it? You say in the last chapter that we need to cut carbon emissions, which seems easier said than done. For example, one suggestion is cap and trade, but that seems politically impossible to implement.
Well, I think this is such a broad argument that this book makes that we could talk for all day about each individual subject and what we have to do to stop it, to stop the worst from happening. I think the thing that I would like to leave people with is this notion that we need to try everything that works. We need to do everything. We can't rely on geoengineering and not cut carbon emissions. We need to do both. We need to at least know what our options are and do the research that we need to do. You know, we need to keep up with viruses. We need to keep looking into them. It's a race. It really is a race. And the same thing with computer malware. We are racing the bad guys, and it's a constant battle.
What are scientists most fearful of?
The scientists are most fearful of the things that I've written in this book.
Altogether.
These are the things the scientists are fearful of.
Uh-huh. But do you have much hope for the future?
I'm an optimist. I think...
I'm getting on in years. As far as I'm concerned, all of this is going to happen after I'm dead. So maybe I shouldn't worry all that
well,
much.
Well, you know, I have a daughter who's 19 and a son who's 16, and I sometimes worry about the world that they're going to grow up in. But what gives me optimism about this is that the people that I've talked to write this book are just so darn smart, and they're worried, and they're committed, and they work very hard, and it just gives me a feeling that we're going to think our way out of it.
Although we have politicians who would argue that everything you say here is just not true.
Well, you discard science at your peril.
Fred Gutterl's book, The Fate of the Species, Why the Human Race May Cause Its Own Extinction and How We Can Stop It, is published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.